From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for the Ides of March, not Julius Caesar's favorite day. Checking the calendar, your Milwaukee Bucks are home for a couple of games this week. Sunday, it's the Suns, and Thursday night, the Nets are in town. The Brewers' home opener, April 2nd, is just a couple of weeks away. Milwaukee's Winter Farmers Market is open Saturday, and of course, it's St. Patrick's Day on Sunday. And what could be the most fun event of the weekend is a Girl Scout cookies and wine pairing at Vino and Third Ward. I think that sounds like fun. We have some strange stories today. A Long Island vegan market is accused of selling Dunkin' Donuts as vegan and gluten-free. The first clue that something wasn't vegan or gluten-free had to be that they tasted good. Well, more than a dozen fans of the Kansas City Chiefs forgot to dress for the weather. Their playoff game in January was played in near record cold. Frostbite caused them to have digits and toes removed, and more surgeries are expected. They should have listened to their moms when they said, "Put some gloves on for crying out loud." A Brazilian woman died after a butt lift procedure in Miami. Not to make fun of the tragedy, but how high were they going to lift it? Off we go to Alaska, where the world's famous Iditarod sled dog race just concluded, and Dallas Seavey is the winner, even with a two-hour penalty. He got the penalty for not properly gutting a moose. It was a moose he shot on the race course. And apparently that's a standard penalty. It's just business as usual. Well, that rule book must be fun to read. And finally, Pigasso, not Picasso, but Pigasso, the famous painting pig, whose art sold for thousands of dollars, has passed away at the tender age of 8. And I can use the word tender when I'm talking about a pig, right? Picasso was rescued by animal rights activists, and the pig's artwork supported the sanctuary where he lived. Let's have a moment of silence for this talented oinker and for Bullwinkle, too. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Joel Dreesen, Kendall Bauer, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you for not referring to me as a talented oinker, Max. I do appreciate the kind words here. NASDAQ down 0.7% this week, down 112 points. The S&P 500 down just 7 points, down 0.1%. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average, after losing 190 points on Friday, down 8 points for the week total. That's basically flat for the year. The Dow now up 3.1, the S&P up 7.5, and the NASDAQ up 6.5%. You know, Dave, maybe the place to start today with the Fed on tap for another meeting next week is what seems to be written about now is this last-mile inflation. You know, this idea that the hardest thing for delivery companies, Amazons of the world to solve is not how do you get the product from one side of the country or one side of the globe to the other, but how do you get it to the end user? And the Fed's dealing now on the inflationary front with, we've gotten the product, we've gotten inflation around the globe, now we just got to get that last little bit. We got to get it back down to that 2% target. And it seems like maybe inflation's been a little stickier than many thought it might otherwise should have been, certainly than the Fed thought maybe it was going to be. And potentially that's changing the narrative a little bit on interest rates.
Certainly has, Kyle, and this last bit has definitely been a struggle. I think when you peel apart the numbers a little bit, you really see how big of a piece of this the housing numbers are as it relates to this last bit of inflation. And historically speaking, that's been a very difficult number to move and has a tendency to lag any Fed action probably by the longest amount of time. So I think the Fed's done a decent job. I think they're being patient. They're looking at the data. And I think they're very comfortable remaining a little elevated for some extended periods here as long as the economy continues to show the signs of strength that it's showing. And I think that's really the important part of it is what's happening to the economy.
And Dave, I think a lot of times we look at kind of the short term, the news of the moment, and we had the numbers this week on consumer price index and producers price index for the month of February. And if we just look at that one month, not a lot has changed, and that gets frustrating. In fact, the CPI number actually went up year to year, and that's frustrating because we expect you know, inflation to keep going down because of the higher interest rates that the Fed imposed. But if you look longer term, it isn't that bad. It's more like you know, we had this, you know, we were at 9.1% in mid 2022. Now we're down around, we got to 3% in what was it in 2023, and we've been stuck around there ever since. So it's all, you know, 10 months or so that we've been stuck around 3%. So going from 9% to 3% was quite a jump, but it's getting back down to 2% where the Fed wants it. That's going to be the harder job. Also looking at the preferred number that the Fed likes to look at, they look at all sorts of things, but their preferred measure of inflation is the personal consumption expenditure number that comes out with the GDP report. And that is always tends to run cooler than the CPI number. The CPI is at 3.2% for February. The last number we had on the PCE index, it was down around 2.4%. So that's closer to that 2% mark.
And I think the Fed has an educational hurdle as well, right? And that often those numbers are pretty misunderstood. This idea that inflation needs to come back down, as we've been saying from the very beginning, is not an idea that prices come back down, but rather that the rate of change in prices comes down. And so the Fed has a bit of a messaging problem if there's a large portion of people that believe that prices need to come back to where they were 6 months, a year, 2 years ago, because the reality is that can be as damaging, if not more, as inflationary pressures. If you start to get into a declining price environment, a deflationary environment, now you get consumers that are saying, maybe I'll hold off on that big ticket purchase because it's going to be a little cheaper 6 months from now. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in the other direction. Deflationary pressures cause more deflationary pressures, cause, I think, some potential for pretty meaningful economic slowdown. It's why that 2% inflation target is such a meaningful target to shoot for. The Fed has kind of determined over the years that that's a happy medium of we keep the consumer engaged, we keep them understanding that, yeah, it's the right thing to buy this when you need it. You don't need to buy it all a bunch now and save it up, but likewise, you probably don't want to wait because it is going to get more expensive over time. You know, I think with the Fed meeting next week, Kendall, there's plenty of stuff that is out there. The idea of higher for longer, the idea that perhaps that's a healthy place to be for the economy. But it seems like investors are pretty motivated by what the Fed has to say.
Yeah, and just to kind of bring back in what we were just discussing too with the CPI numbers, I think I look at it, frankly, as a glass half full situation. I mean, the fact that we're arguing or the media is up in a storm about 10 basis points, you know, 20 basis points from inflation month to month, I think we're closer to the end than certainly we were 2 years ago. But I think, you know, coming up to these meetings, you tend to see more volatility. Pretty clear, I think, that it'd be very unlikely to see the Fed cut in March. I think maybe some of the volatility stoking fears about potential for a 25 basis point raise. I think that being pretty unlikely as well. So I don't know. I think, you know, steady as she goes, higher rates for longer, as we were talking to a little bit ago, isn't necessarily a bad thing. Folks that are utilizing things like money markets or short-term fixed income options are still going to, you know, come out ahead with a nice yield and some nice stability in their portfolio.
And of course, with the Fed meeting next week comes the summary of economic projections that's released every other Fed meeting. I think a lot hangs on those projections in that it really tells us what the Fed is thinking about longer-term objectives for rates. It tells us what the Fed is thinking about where inflation, the 10-year Treasury, the economic growth forecast is. And it's a nice kind of I think, way for the Fed to say, well, if things break the way we think they're going to break, here's what you should expect. I think one thing that's clear from interest rates this week and a meaningful jump in the 10-year and the 5-year Treasury is that that's beginning to get baked in, not just to what I think the Fed is going to say next week, but the market is starting to represent, okay, yeah, long term, later this year, probably the overnight rate has to start to come down. But if we are as strong as we think we are economically, maybe the 10-year, maybe the 5-year Treasury aren't going to go down quite as quickly and quite as significantly as short-term rates do. And so that helps inform us a little bit, I think, on where we want to position portfolios going forward. I think it's a good reminder that if the short-term interest rates come down a little quicker, there's a near-term benefit to things like short-term bonds from that rate move. But longer term, you don't get to capture as much yield, as much interest rate, because now as those bonds mature, you're getting less. And so trying to find the sweet spot in the yield curve for how do we invest the fixed income piece of the portfolio, well, those targets move as interest rates move. And I think it's why the Fed's conversation is so important. You know, the thing I keep hearing from clients is that they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And Kendall, I was given a quote this week from Peter Lynch that I think tells the story pretty cleanly. I know you're familiar with it. You and I were talking about it a little bit yesterday. But potentially a reminder that, you know, if you spend all your time waiting for that other shoe, maybe you miss out on some of the opportunity.
Yeah, I think it goes back to one of the core principles or philosophies here, you know, that we talk to our clients about all the time. It's time in the market, not timing the market. And I talked about this a few weeks ago, too, that we even looked at some studies that, you know, looked at some historical returns a year, 3, 5 years out from all-time highs. And what we found were, you know, even people that were putting new money in towards those highs still came out pretty well over the long term. And we all know bull markets climb a wall of worry. So I think there's a bit of a myth there that just because we're doing as well as we are or, you know, breaking all-time highs, that it means there's a correction around the corner. Now, there could be. We know that, and we prepare for that way in advance with the way we try to, you know, balance our clients' portfolios from the get-go. But I'm not necessarily convinced that it's such a bad thing that we're hitting all new time highs and we are chugging along as well as we have been.
Yeah, you know, Peter Lynch said far more money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections or anticipating corrections than has been lost in the corrections themselves. And then Warren Buffett followed up those comments, not directly followed them up, but later on came out and said, inactivity strikes us as intelligent behavior. And Dave, I think the challenge that we often face in talking to clients and talking to our investors is that often the right thing to do is nothing, or maybe go the other way, right? Take more risk at a time when other people want to take less. And maybe it's some of that contrarianism that can help to at least give the sense that we're doing something, even if it isn't always the thing we think we should be doing.
Yeah, Kyle, those guys have made some astute comments as they described what a lot of investor behaviors have become over time. And I think you're right. I think, you know, despite the fact that valuations are elevated, when you look at historical standards, Joel, I think your data has the, from FactSet, had the forward PE just over 20, which, you know, that's elevated. We don't see a lot of forward PEs on the S&P 500 over 20. But as Kyle and both Kendall pointed out, markets can stay irrational for a long time. Longer than you can say stay solvent is attributed to John Maynard Keynes, I believe. So it isn't a matter of, to what your point is, Kyle, is as soon as something becomes expensive by historical standards, that should suddenly trigger you to make a massive change in your strategy. Because, you know, don't forget that momentum is a very, very powerful force inside of markets.
And I think there's some nuance to add to that, Dave, too. It doesn't mean that it's not a good time to maybe take some chips off the table, you know, given the run we've seen stocks have. If you have income needs, or if you're somebody that has to take a required minimum distribution from a qualified account, that's potentially a great thing to take some gains from stocks. It doesn't mean you have to go completely in the other direction, but just that simple idea of, you know, we've had a great run. Doesn't mean it's going to slow down, but why not use that for those that need it as an opportunity to rebalance, to, you know, take a look at the riskier portfolio, but maybe fund some upcoming income needs.
Joel, we had some other economic data this week. Obviously, consumer prices, producer prices, big ahead of the Fed, but details on retail sales, consumer sentiment, almost as important in my mind to kind of the broader direction of the economy.
Right, Kyle, we talk all the time about how consumer spending drives two-thirds of the economy in the United States, and that consumer sentiment number is sort of a pre-indication of how consumers are feeling about spending. So we got word on that today. It was a preliminary look at how consumers are feeling in March, and they're about the same as they were in February. And in fact, the University of Michigan, which puts out that consumer survey-based index, they said that, you know, they're expecting that consumers are going to be kind of, you know, in neutral until after the elections in November, which seems like a long time away. But then I actually think we're going to see more things from consumers between now and then. But right now, just to remind everybody, I mean, consumer sentiment is sort of midway between where we were when the COVID pandemic started and the record low that they had in consumer sentiment just 2 years ago. So we're kind of halfway between there, which again, kind of like the consumer price index with the inflation number, we're sort of stuck for a little bit. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And the other number that we had on consumer spending was the retail sales number, and that retail sales are the biggest part of consumer spending. And that was up for only the second time in 5 months, and it was the highest since September. So that's suggesting that consumers are still in the game. You know, we have been looking for the economy to slow down because of higher interest rates, and not really seeing that. We had the numbers from the Labor Department last week on job creation, and employers are still adding jobs out there to the surprise of a lot of economic analysts, and the retail sales are still following too.
Joel, you talk about retail spending and its importance to the overall economic picture. I want to point out something that I've heard from clients a number of times in the last week or so. There was a report that came out that was highlighting the fact that credit card debt numbers had gotten to an all-time high. And it concerned a few of my clients thinking, oh my gosh, we have a debt problem on the individual, you know, consumer. And I think it was a little misleading because that number was related to a number of dollars on credit cards. You also have to take into consideration that income is also at an all-time record high, right, as it relates to dollars. And if you look at really the percentage of people's take-home pay that is going towards those credit card payments, it's very much in line with what it was prior to the pandemic. So it isn't as if suddenly consumers are committing a much larger portion of their paycheck to credit cards that would become a problem. It's just that number got bigger because incomes have gotten bigger.
Right, Dave. It's one of those numbers that you have to look beyond mm-hmm. what the headline says, and because sometimes it does indicate that, you know, people are running out of money to spend, and so they're borrowing more. But in this case, it's more of a sign that they're confident that they can pay off those debts, and so they keep spending.
And I think some of that, too, is, you know, one of the biggest generations next to the baby boomers, the millennials, many of which have seen large increases in their wages over the last 2 years, many of which are also priced out of the housing market. So where is some of that discretionary spending going? You know, if you look at kind of that shift between goods and services that we tend to keep an eye on, we've start to see some of that money move back towards services, and some of that obviously being spent with credit cards. So to your point, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You have all these people, you know, a younger generation that can't necessarily buy a home right now, so they're going to spend their money on something, and I think they're in a position to actually pay some of that credit card debt off versus years past when maybe it would accumulate.
We keep a close eye on revolving debt, on debt service, on delinquencies in certain areas of the market. You know, there's certainly some I'd say yellow flags right now, not red flags, and things like auto delinquencies. But when you look at the big picture of the consumer's balance sheet, I think you all are hitting on all the right points here, which is from an asset perspective, they've never had more money. From a wealth perspective, consumers have never been wealthier. And so from a pure dollars perspective, we can support a little more debt. From a debt service perspective, right, what does it mean to your household balance sheet to service the debt that's out there? We're really only back to pre-pandemic levels at this point. Remember that the last few years look exceptionally strong, in part because there wasn't a ton of things you could spend money on that you wanted to, in part because, generally speaking, you were pulling money in from more sources, including things like stimulus, government stimulus, which padded pocketbooks for a while. And that if a lot of that money has now been spent down as we think it has, well, it's only natural that if some of that spending were to continue, we would see debt levels return to where they were prior to the pandemic. And so I think there's certainly some things to watch there. The one I'm most interested in right now is the auto loan delinquencies, which have spiked a little bit. And that those tend to be a sign that perhaps things are a little soft in one area of the market. But again, just like with inflation, just like with the other information we're talking about a month or two worth of data here. We're not talking about, you know, months and months of trend of really bad data. We're talking about, okay, things are starting to look a little elevated in a small window. And so I'm not overly concerned there. You know, maybe the other thing that tends to come up this time of year, and we got a question from a listener from the great state of Georgia asking us, hey, I got my tax documents, and, you know, I know that you have all the information on what I paid for the things I sold last year in my taxable account, but for whatever reason, the tax statements don't show it. Why is that? And so, Dave, Kendall, I know you both get this question. I'm wondering if either of you want to shed some light on maybe what's going on there. And again, perhaps, you know, how we can come to help clients get some of the supporting documentation they might need to give the information to their tax preparers in terms of what they paid for what they sold.
Okay, I think it's a great question this time of year because it is pretty consistent for anybody that has a taxable account. You know, we had a law change back in 2011 that impacted individual securities, and I think it applied to mutual funds in 2012, where there was any of your purchases were going to be tracked by the custodian, and that information for those costs would show up on your 1099. Anything you purchased prior to that was really on the shoulders of the taxpayer to track that information. Now, we try to supply that information as a service to our clients, so certainly for anything that they purchase while a client of ours at that time. So I think the important thing to take away from this is when you're preparing your taxes, especially when you have a taxable account and you made some sales, make sure that you go through the effort of obtaining that cost basis. It can be confusing because if you've had multiple sales in the account and perhaps one of the securities is covered, something you purchased after 2012, and maybe a sale applies to something that was uncovered, you may see some cost basis there, but you might be missing some. So just a heads up to really take a good solid look at that cost basis.
And Dave, that's probably another reminder to don't wait till the last minute to get all your records together to prepare your taxes, because if you've got some extra hiccups like that, you probably want a little more time for them.
You mean April 14th is really not the time to do that?
You know, I think it's just a good reminder that the tax filing system we have is complex, and there is a reason why there are tax professionals out there. And they should know the answers to these questions. They should be able to point you in the right direction in terms of, yeah, that cost basis isn't provided on the statement because you bought it probably before 2011, but your records should have that. And if they don't, hopefully your broker's records do, so that you can help to put together the support necessary to say, no, here's what we paid for those shares. Far too many taxpayers try to do this on their own. Far too many taxpayers don't know the right questions to ask. And so, you know, if you've got a little more complicated scenario, it does help to have somebody to bounce those questions off of we're happy to help to the extent we can, but at the end of the day, we don't sign your tax return. We're not the ones that are signing off on that information. And so you want to make sure you're getting good answers to your questions. With that, we enjoy doing the program for you. We will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.